Tim McCabe's here.
We ready? Good morning. Convening today's Joint Committee on Tax Credit. Welcome, everyone. We only have three things on our agenda, but we have a very vigorous agenda. We are going to start with a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2523A. You want to explain what this is, Chris? And I think I might ask Tim McCabe to come up and answer any questions that might come up from the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Basically, House Bill 2523 moves the manufacturing portion of the Betsy from the administration of it from the Department of Energy to Business Oregon. You have paperwork. This is a public hearing, right?
Yes, and possible work session.
Right. You do have a dash A5, which clarifies the sunset date, and you do have a fiscal statement for the dash A5, and you have a no impact revenue statement for the dash A5.
Okay. For the committee, this has been under discussion last session, and came to us from which committee? From the Revenue Committee, and before that, it was in the Transportation and Economic Development Committee. So it has been it is a well-rounded proposal, as they are, and we have experts here to answer any questions the committee may have. Boy, are we easy today.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We are in work session.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would move House Bill.
There's a dash five. Is there a dash?
Do we have a minute?
Yes. But possible work session. I just moved to work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I do that? Because I opened both.
Okay. I didn't see an amendment.
Did you say the dash five?
This is dash
A5. It should be in your packet.
It's the fifth piece of paper.
All right.
And what that does.
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Is on page 2, it modifies section 3. Section 3, the language there, refers to a sunset basically on the final certification of the project.
Okay, but that's no change from current law, correct?
Correct. The A5 is current law. In current law, there is that language that is in the A5. It says a preliminary certification has to be issued before January 1, 2014. When 2523A got drafted, that same sunset was there. It was structured a little bit differently, and to get there in the A version of the bill, you have to look at a combination of Section 3 and Section 15.
Oh.
And so it's just more complicated.
So A5 clarifies.
A5 simplifies it and clarifies it and puts that one statement where you can look at it and read that the taxpayer has to receive the preliminary certification by January 1, 2014. To find the sunset in 2523A, you have to look at Section 15, which shows how much that can be certified by the department, combined with Section 3 when the taxpayers have to start claiming it.
Oh.
So it's more complicated in the A, so the A5 simplifies that.
That's a good thing. Madam Chair, I would move the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2523.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves the dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2523. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2523 as amended to the both floors.
What's our script?
To the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2523A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. This is our first vote out of this committee. I would like a roll call.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Senator Telford?
Aye.
Senator Hess?
Aye.
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Gelson?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye. Apparently, the motion passes. We start out with very good spirit and unanimity. And with that, I'll close the public hearing and work.
Carrier.
Okay, we need two carriers. Representative Reed would like to carry it on the House. On the Senate side?
Okay. Unless Hess wants, Senator Hess wants to. You want to carry it?
Okay.
He wants to carry it.
Okay, Senator Reed and Senator Hess will be our carriers. Thank you very much, and I'm going to close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2523A, and thank you very much, committee. That was nicely done. I'm going to open public hearing back up on Senate Bill 317A. We did not complete testimony on that when we last met, so there are some folks here who've been waiting. I'm going to go off the sheet from last week. If they're not in the room, there's some that are on both sheets, but is Ray Burstad here? He was there last week and is not. Cindy Robert, Jack Isselman, and Ann Hannes, and Paul Grove. I guess there's only three. So three of you, Cindy Robert, Jack Isselman, and Ann Hannes. You were all here last week and signed up both today and last week, and I appreciate your waiting. And Paul Grove, are you here?
Yes.
Okay. There. Well,
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Isselman. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association, but I'd like to yield my spot with your approval to one of our members, Steve Dahl, who was unavailable to be here last Thursday to testify, but is here today. So
thank you, Steve.
With that,
welcome.
And I can open up a seat for another witness.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm from the city of Grants Pass, so I get the 100-mile exemption, I guess, is what they tell me.
And your name?
I'm sorry. My name is Steve Dahl. I work for the city of Grants Pass as Economic Development Coordinator. And I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 317, the extension of the sunset date for the tax credit for electronic commerce in enterprise zones or cities designated for electronic commerce. I'll give you three examples from the Grants Pass area why this is an important bill for us to have. The first is first call resolution. They came to the Grants Pass 2 years ago, and the reason they came, they were choosing between us and another city, and we had the e-commerce overlay. Since that time, they have hired 173 people in the Grants Pass area. Now, for those who don't know Josephine County, it has averaged one of the highest unemployment rates in the state of Oregon, second only, I think, to the Bend-Prineville area. They invested $250,000 in new property, and they took generated $3,598,400 in new annual payroll in Grants Pass. First call annual payroll generates a new personal income tax to the state of Oregon per year for $179,200. The cost of the state business tax, it's a one-time cost that can take over 5 years, is $62,000. So the profit, if you will, for the state, for the enterprise zone, for the three-year exemption, is $463,850 in new income taxes coming into the state because of that $62,000 investment. Now, we also have DCS, which is a collection agency. They took advantage of the e-commerce overlay, and they installed $191,500 of new eligible equipment, and this was in 2008. The e-commerce cost for that for the state was $75,000. DCS hired 25 new employees, and the average wage for a DCS employee is between $60,000 and $75,000. So you figured that was $1.5 million of new payroll coming into the Grants Pass area because of the e-commerce overlay. And the net profit for the state for this was $150,000 after 3 years. Fire Mountain Gems, which is an internet company. They sell beads. They're the largest internet bead company in the world. They invested a $4.5 million project between the Enterprise Zone and the e-commerce overlay. The e-commerce overlay part of it was $687,905. The state cost of that fee, the one-time fee that can take over 5 years, was $171,976.25. The average salary for Fire Mountain Gems is about $35,000 a year, which is about the median income for Josephine County, Grants Pass. And they hired new 70 new employees in this one time with that. The new payroll was $2,450,000. And the net profit for the state was $195,523.75. The point I'm trying to make here is you have to think or change your thought about the e-commerce tax credit as not as a cost to the state, but an investment by the state. As I've mentioned here, you're getting about a 14% return on your investment. And I'm sure Treasurer Wheeler would love to get 14% return on any investment they have right now. You know, our traded local sector companies have the ability to locate anywhere in the world and routinely are contacted by other states to relocate. Having effective programs like the Enterprise Zone e-commerce overlay keeps them in Oregon and, as illustrated above, brings a new tax revenue to the state. And that's why I'm a big believer in the Senate Bill 317A.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. I'll entertain questions after all the panel, if you don't mind. And we have your testimony before us, if you'd summarize.
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. That testimony is also from the League of Oregon Cities and Oregon Economic Development Association. I want to call your attention to other letters that you should have in your packet, such as from RENTRAC, the Economic Development for Central Oregon, Ready So Ready. I think you'll hear the same kind of themes that you heard from Steve Dahl. They strongly support the electronic commerce tax credit because it is one that brings big returns to the state. I think Steve has illustrated both the benefits to the economy and the net revenue gain to the state. For these reasons, and because they work in concert with the locally approved enterprise zones, we urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Chair Berger, Chair Bailey, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department, and here to talk very briefly in support of Senate Bill 317. I won't rehash what Ann and Steve discussed. We'll talk briefly about an example that the department encountered within the past year involved RENTRAC that Ann mentioned, and the company had faced a decision to stay in Oregon or locate elsewhere. And the availability of this program and the e-commerce overlay was an integral and key component in their decision to stay in Oregon, and that is 200-plus jobs at about $65,000 per job, and those are the types of jobs that we want to keep and grow here in Oregon, and the program was of critical importance to that company. So just wanted to briefly lend our support for that bill, and Arthur Fish is here with the department to answer any technical questions that the committee may have.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Well, it's more not a question necessarily, but, you know, as we face looking at these credits, expenditures, and sunsetting them or not, you know, and we're facing a huge budgetary problem, it's important to know, in my mind, how much money is going to be generated in the form of payroll taxes, et cetera, to offset the cost of these expenditures. And I've got to congratulate Grants Pass and Mr. Dahl for being the first person who's actually given us the information in which to weigh the return on the investment. You know, I've been asking for that information over and over and over again, so I thank you for taking the effort to come up with the actual dollars that are coming back into the state because of this incentive that's been provided. So I appreciate Grants Pass and you doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. For Grants Pass, when you use the term profit, I think you're talking about net tax receipts versus tax expenditures.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And but just as a comment,
yes.
I agree completely with Senator Telfer now that I know what we mean when we say net profit. This is the kind of information that is really, really beneficial to us as we think about extending. When we can write a tax credit that results in a net gain in the economy and a net gain in our revenues, it's a win for everybody.
Thank you very much. Cindy, Robert, you are the only one left on the list here. And anyone else who would like to speak on 317? Okay, Cindy.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the city of Medford. Last week, you all discussed sending a letter to Congress urging them to continue the federal funding for timber counties. And in Southern Oregon, that's very important to us. But I will tell you that as far as business goes, this piece of legislation has just as much impact. And for all of you, especially for Senator Telfer, I will tell you some facts. Medford was one of the first four companies in Oregon to be designated as an e-commerce zone in 2002. 39 companies have been approved for these benefits. A study in 2009 said the e-commerce zone had helped create 700 new jobs, with projections of more than 900 by 2020, just with the businesses that have already been approved. The e-commerce zone has generated $42 million in gross regional product, which is expected to grow to $92 million by 2020, again, just with the e-commerce companies already approved. The tax revenue has been just as impressive, with almost $10 million in tax revenue expected to be generated by 2020 by those e-commerce zones already in existence. I know that the tax credit issue is difficult and the competition is tough, but I will tell you, without the businesses and jobs that are created through the e-commerce zone incentive in Oregon, in Southern Oregon, there would be fewer businesses to tax. We desperately need this. In 2004, I believe it was, Medford was recognized by Inc. magazine as the fifth best state in the nation in which to do business, and that was because of our e-commerce zone and our enterprise zone. So I urge you to continue this. It'll help Medford thrive and grow and continue to bring new businesses into Southern Oregon, where, as you know, we have some really dark days ahead of us.
Thank you, Cindy. Questions for Cindy? Thank you for coming. Thank you, Mr. Dahl, for coming, particularly from so far. Anyone else want to speak on 317? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 317A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3582. Members of the committee, this is a bit of an omnibus bill that includes a more generic Betsy business energy tax credit, what we're now calling Connie and Betsy combined. It's conservation energy tax credits, and Chris can, and I'll have him tee it up. We have, I think, a great interest in it, and a lot of folks who want to talk about this program.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, in your packet there is a one-pager with the title Tax Credit for Business Energy Facilities. And this is just a high-level view of the kinds of projects that get certified for a Betsy. And as you can see there, there are three different categories, at least three different categories of projects. You have conservation projects, the so-called Connie, renewable energy projects, the so-called Jenny, and then the manufacturing projects, the Manny, and that was the House Bill 2523 that you just passed out. And part of the Betsy has been around since 1979, so it has a long history with some significant recent changes, and there are a wide variety of kinds of projects that get certified under the Betsy. So looking at it this way, the policy intent was to really create separate bins and separate credits to break them out according to policy goal and kind of type of project. For all that Betsy is, there are a number of criticisms against it about what it does or doesn't do, and it depends on which projects one looks at. For example, just kind of marching down that list, the conservation projects, the general policy goal is to reduce energy consumption to help with energy security and environmental concerns. These projects tend to, the goal is to reduce energy use. So you have projects like insulation, lighting, solar system on buildings, high efficiency appliances, and alternative fuel vehicles. The structure of that credit is a 35% credit claimed over 5 years. You get 10% in each of the first 2 years and then 5% in the subsequent 3 years. So that's 35% of the project cost. And then a subcategory to that are combined heat and power projects get a 50% credit. Some statistics from 2010, the final certification, there were about 2,000 credits issued where the average credit was just under $20,000. And in terms of categories, the credits range from an average of around $200 for appliances up to $1 million for transportation projects. And in total, just under $39 million in credits were issued. There is no program cap for conservation projects. There is a project cap of $10 million, and it has a sunset of June 30th, 2012 for final certification. And by way of process, an applicant comes into the Department of Energy, applies for a pre-certification. The department processes that and either rejects or approves it and grants the pre-certification. Then the project owner has a time period to complete the project and then come back to the Department of Energy to apply for final certification. And upon receipt of final certification, they can claim the tax credit. The second broad category are renewable energy projects. And here the policy goal is to comply with the RPS and as well as energy security. These types of projects include deriving energy from biomass, wind, hydro, geothermal, or photovoltaic or solar thermal. And the credit structure here is a little more complicated than the CONI. For projects up to $10 million, it's a 50% credit over 5 years, 10% in each of those years. For projects that cost more than $10 million, it's a 50% credit over 6 years. There's zero in the year of final certification, and then the 5 years at 10%. And then home builders have a credit that's up to $12,000, depending on the installed systems. Now, for 2010, only about 200 credits were issued, where the average credit was about $200,000. And the range for the average credit was about $6,500 for home builder credits, up to $4.5 million for R&D credits. And here, about $43 million in credits were issued. So right off the bat, you have $43 million for Jenny out of 200 projects, as compared to Connie, where you had 2,000 projects for just about the same amount of credits, so vastly different sizes. And then the manufacturing, the policy goal is high wage job creation and economic growth, and these are for projects that manufacture equipment used to produce or harness renewable energy, and it's a 5-year 50% credit, and that was in 25-23. The one piece that's not on here is the transferability of the credit. If you have whether the entity is taxable or not, they can sell the credit, and that helps facilitate some of the project funding, and so you can have other taxpayers claiming the credit as opposed to the project owner. So that's a very high level, quick run through of the different bins.
I'm going to ask Bob Repine and whoever he wants from the Oregon Department of Energy to come up first. I'm trying to decide whether it's better first or last, but first, and answer any questions and sort of continue this overview of how this program works. Okay. Don't all rush up at once. I think I contemplated having you come last, but please stick around in case there are questions that come up. This is our first look, members of the committee, of one of the bigger things on our plate in terms of impact. So I appreciate you coming and all the rest of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, I am Bob Repine, Acting Director for the Department of Energy, and I'll let my staff introduce themselves and they have an opportunity to speak. I think Mr. Allenack has done a good job of doing a high flyover of the program. He's hit on really the most important points of the programs, shows how the credits are taken. One of the things I'd like to point out to people, and I'll share this with you, when you see the 35% credit claim for 5 years for the conservation, that realize that means that The credit's worth 35%. If the project's 100%, that means somebody else or the applicant, in most cases, has chipped in the balance of that money. So this, so if for a 35% credit, that means there's $2 for every $1 that the state invests. The state invests $1, so there's $2 that's ponied up by the actual project itself.
Madam Chair, yes. But aren't there other subsidies that some of these projects are eligible for?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, correct. There are other subsidies, but there is other so there are subsidies that can be available through federal programs and other state programs and other utility programs. But at the same time, there is a leverage that comes with this. So it's not just a dollar for a dollar that's used for the credit program.
But Madam Chair, if I could follow up, how do you handle this credit when there are other subsidies? Do you take the 35% off of the amount that's left after the other subsidies are taken off the top, or do you do it by the whole project?
Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Burdick, the statutes prescribes how we go about taking those credits off. Certain credits are reduced, and other credits by statute do not get reduced. So there are some inconsistencies on what gets taken off, but some of the ones that are prescribed by law that be removed are removed, reduced from the overall project cost, then the calculations are made off of that. There are other type of programs, such as federal credits, are not reduced from a cost of a project like this. So they're left in the
calculation. So theoretically, you could have someone who is very energetic about getting these other credits get quite a high percentage of the project covered.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, committee members, there is the probability, there is a threshold that says that nobody shall receive over 100%. And so at the end of the day, when we add up all the puts, well, I'm only suggesting what the law says today. And the law says that effectively those credits are allowed to be taken or considered or not considered, and that the agency will not award anything up to over 100% of a project. So in theory, somebody could walk in, if they were clever enough, they could figure out ways to leverage other people's money in order to have a project paid for. But that is a rarity more than the norm. But that is the way, again, the current law suggests.
Thank you. May I continue? Go ahead.
Oh, so again, in reflection, maybe I don't want to go down this road for renewables, but I will. The same thing holds true for renewables. It's 50%. So that, again, means for every dollar that is invested for a project up to $20 million, that means the credit is awarded, and then there's another matching dollar for it. And again, as the senator pointed out, that could be some other fund that's other form of subsidy as well. But it's considered in the same way as the renewables. As certain projects are, we reduce certain other incentives away from the project cost, and then we calculate it based on the 50%. The one piece that I think that sometimes is overlooked, many of the renewable projects, particularly around the larger projects such as wind and or larger solar applications, and particularly wind, projects are in the range of $200, $300, $700, and $1 billion. And for a project of that size, under the current program, they would still only receive a maximum of $10 million credit. So the leverage in larger renewables can be huge compared to the smaller projects. So don't believe just because there's a $20 million threshold that everybody's coming to get $10 million in credits. So there are projects that are out there that are $500 and up to $1 billion that are seeking those credits in the past. And as we talked about the manufacturing project program prior, this does reside in my agency today. And as you just took action, that this part of the program will be removed. But effectively, it's been a good program for the state of Oregon. It has recruited lots of businesses that I think Oregon is proud of, and it has created beneficial jobs, new jobs that have been created in various parts of our states. So, Madam Chair, I think what the best thing to do is, if there's questions, we'll try to answer those questions.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I kind of failed to mention that all of these originally were under the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. It was sort of my construct in moving, really actually last session when we delved into this, that it's a bigger thing and that there ought to be a way to understand it by dividing it. And so this is in some way before you a parsing that it was my convenience in understanding how these programs work. And nothing more in terms of the conservation and the renewables and the manufacturing. It helped me. I hope it helps you. But as far as the department is concerned, it has been one program under the business center. Am I correct in that? So this dividing up was something that was more or less directed by people like me who can take things in smaller bites. So all of these are, in essence, part of a bigger program. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the renewable, if we have a statute, which we do, that requires 25% renewables by the year 25, why should we spend tax dollars to do what is required by law?
Wow, there you go.
There's a softball for you.
Madam Chair, committee members, struggling with this one. I think the 25% renewables by 2025 is a goal set out by the state of Oregon. I think in order to help facilitate it and get us to that point, I think the credits have played a key role of getting us to where we are today, meeting the first kind of the test threshold. I think it's 15% by 2015. Am I correct?
So
there's an interim threshold. So we've been able to accomplish that at this point in time. As we move to the 2025, that becomes probably a little more difficult task. And while you can arguably say that it's mandated in the state of Oregon, the goal is to get to be at that point. And I believe that short of some of these credits and some participation by the state of Oregon, the ability for industry to get to that point, despite whether or not it's a requirement in the law, it's going to be a very difficult task for utilities to meet those goals.
Well, in the context, Madam Chair, of the environment in which we find ourselves struggling to support our core functions of government, to meet an arbitrary goal and then subsidize it with those dollars, it is really a tough issue. Particularly if, you have the PUC and investor-owned utilities that cover most of the state, and if the statute directs them to go to renewables, there's a way to recover those costs through the rate-making process, rather than through tax dollars that are taken away from basic services. And I haven't made that connection yet as to why we need to be spending the extent of tax dollars. The cumulative effect of all of these is profound.
Yes. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question similar to the Senator's. Having done all the work that your department has done in breaking these projects into parts, perhaps you could share with us your thoughts on how we can best avoid the damage that's certainly going to come as we reduce these credits. And, of course, what I would like is your thoughts on where we should reduce more, where we should reduce less, we've been looking primarily at the good that flows from these credits. I'm more interested, I think, at this point in avoiding as much as we can of the bad as we reduce how much we're spending.
Madam Chair, committee members, another great question, which will cause people to pull arrows out of their quivers behind me. So thank you for that opportunity to expose myself. But I am the acting director, so it's okay. I think the industry, in these economic times, and I understand the economic times we're in making these difficult choices, there's a couple things that I would point to. And again, these are just indicators of what other power-related organizations are looking at. Probably the most prevalent report that's most notable is the Northwest Power Council's report, where they have suggested that efficiencies in Oregon will be gained by 85% by conservation activities. That's where they believe the economic opportunities are. At least that's where energy conservation will play a key role in meeting our energy demands.
So that would suggest to you that conservation programs are a contributor to that goal. That means to take existing facilities, both housing, commercial buildings, industrial buildings, and maximize their efficiency, their energy use by assisting them in changing out equipment, and insulating their shells of the buildings better, doing a series of things that will get you to saving power that's being generated today. So maybe it delays or postpones the need for additional creation of power. Now, having said that, that competes against the state's goals of renewable portfolio by 25% by 2025. So you've got to have that balance in there at the same time. The issue, I think, that we're starting to see, quite frankly, on renewables, which I think is still a very important part of the portfolio for Oregon, is placements are becoming more challenging. What we used to be able to do 10 or 15 years ago in putting renewable facilities on the landscape of Oregon have changed. There are changes around the neighboring communities who at one time welcomed these types of programs when they only saw 20 or 30 red blinking lights on the horizon at night outside their front door, but some of them stand in front of their front doors today or potentially are standing envisioning there will be thousands of blinking red lights in front of their doors. So we have concerns that were not necessarily concerns in the past. We find that the renewable industry also is having a much more difficult time placing because of some of the inherent conflicts between natural resource issues as well. And so that industry has found a little bit more challenging, I think, at least in my opinion, to be able to create projects that create the renewable opportunities. So picking a winner and loser is very difficult. I think in this economic time, as you have reviewed projects in the past, one of the conditions that you don't have with the Betsy program historic in the law today is that there really is no requirement of jobs created or economic value that's produced through the issuing of that credit. Through discussions with the working group that Chair Berger has been involved with and some of you on the committee have been involved with as well, we've talked about, you know, how do you change the criteria? So when making those investments, you are hitting the deliverables that you're trying to accomplish as opposed to we have a tax credit program. If you build something, you're able to get either 35% of it subsidized by the state of Oregon or 50% of it. That really has been the criteria. If you change to designing the programs to be measured on energy production as opposed to what did it cost to build the facilities for renewables, or in conservation, what did it cost to make those improvements, determine it based on the energy you save. So put something that's measurable that you can say, for that kind of money, this is what we got in energy saved or energy produced. Or in the case of renewables, and quite frankly, in conservation, while it's a little more difficult to measure, what are the jobs that come from those, both direct or indirect jobs? Those are standards that you, this committee and others have talked about for since I've been involved with the agency now for almost 2 years, but that's not what the law says. The law does not make that a prescriptive requirement of this program. So if the program's prescriptive standard has been how much did you produce energy or did you save energy, and that's what the bottom line of the program is. If the will of the legislature is in going into the future is to be more prescriptive in what they're looking for, then you're going to need to articulate what are the programs. What, if you're looking for jobs, what are you looking for those jobs? If you're looking for a return on investment, what is that return on investment? What are the things that the agency would have to measure in order to be able to report back to you to say, we did accomplish it or we did not accomplish it? But currently in the law, that doesn't exist.
Thank you. Members, thank you very much. I'm going to let you off the hook, but please don't leave.
No. Oh, I'm sure that there's people in the audience will find a rail for me to sit on.
Okay. Members of the committee, we have 2 pages of, and it's actually more than that, because they have neatly put themselves into a certain amount of panels. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take them in order. However, if there are people out there who don't think they're going to be able to come back on Thursday because I don't think we're going to get through this by 10 o'clock, would you please pass a note to our staff over here, and I'll try and get you in today if possible. So we're going to take them in the order they signed up and in the panels that they have organized themselves around, and I do appreciate that. Penny Mashinsky and Michael Early and Alan Hickenbottom. Bottom. There you go. Thank you. And if you would speak as a panel, and then we'll invite questions as a panel, even though you may not be together. Not assuming. You need to just simply state your name for the record.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Penny Mashinsky, and I'm the environmental manager for Westland Paper Company. I'd like to share our experiences with the Betsy program. Westland Paper is located just south of Portland in Westland, Oregon, right across the river from another mill that declared bankruptcy and closed earlier this year. We're in a little bit different line of business, and we've been a little bit more successful than they've been, but I'm here to tell you that the paper industry has really struggled the last few years. We employ 250 employees in family wage jobs with good benefits. Workforce Oregon estimates there's another 1,100 or so jobs in the metro area that are supported by our business. We're a fairly small business, but we have 7% of the market share of our product in the United States and about 35% here on the West Coast. We manufacture a type of paper called coated free sheet. It's an advertising-type stock, glossy, shiny kind of paper. It's used for magazine covers, for direct mail advertisement, Crate and Barrel prints there, catalogs on our paper. The Bend Tourism magazine is printed on our paper as well. Our biggest little customers are Journal Graphics and Sunbeo, both of who have operations in Portland. Our sales are actually up 9% since 2005, so we're confident that we're doing something right. And one of the things that we think we're doing right is the Betsy program. We've implemented 23 Betsy-supported projects since 2001 with a total capital cost of about $6.5 million. The Betsy has contributed about $1.6 million to that. The savings that we're getting from the program are significant. There's some graphs and data in your packet there. But it works out to about $1.2 million a year in savings. And on the environmental side, we're emitting about 35,000 less tons of CO2 as a result of the energy saved associated with this product. The Betsy program has opened up access to capital for us that is incredibly important to small businesses like ours. Betsy projects don't just improve our energy efficiency. They improve our product quality. They make our workplace safer and more predictable for our employees as well. About a quarter of our business these days is with customers that are specifically interested in sustainably produced paper. And it's been critical that we demonstrate that we've got improvements in our plant operations. They expect us to conserve water, to conserve energy, to conserve raw materials, and the Betsy program has helped us meet those expectations. Betsy has truly made a difference to our success. We're the only type of mill of our type on the West Coast. And we're competing directly with imported papers from the Far East, where labor is cheap and environmental regulations are few and far between. For us to remain competitive, we have to be able to control the things that are controllable. Our employees deserve a decent wage. Our commitment to environmental protection is not negotiable. The one thing we've got control over is energy. Conservation is by far the most cost-effective way for our society to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and to reduce our carbon emissions. The cheapest energy is the stuff you don't use in the first place. The Betsy program has been really important in helping businesses like ours to reduce our consumption, to remain competitive, and to continue to stay in business. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll continue, and then we'll come back for questions. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. Our group represents on electric issues the manufacturing base in Oregon. Our member companies include manufacturers such as Boeing, Precision Castparts, Oregon Steel, high-tech companies such as Intel and Hewlett-Packard, food processors such as ConAgra and NORPAC, and pulp and paper businesses including Westlin, SP Newsprint, Georgia-Pacific, International Paper, and Boise Paper. My message here is brief one. That it's important that the Betsy Conservation Program, be maintained and funded at an adequate level and not be allowed to sunset. As was indicated earlier, all these companies have made conservation investments in the past using relying upon the Betsy, and it has reduced their energy usage and consequently has reduced their energy costs. It has reduced their carbon footprint and made them more environmentally friendly, which has opened up new product markets for them. All of this keeps those companies more competitive, allows them to maintain employment or expand employment, allows them to continue to contribute to their communities and contribute to the state's tax base. I want to talk about why the Betsy is necessary for these investments. At the direction of the legislature, the Department of Energy commissioned a study to answer a couple of questions about Betsy. That study was just completed by a third party, the Industrial Economics, Inc., and submitted to the legislature earlier this month. The first question they looked at was the but-for question. That is, but for the contribution from the Betsy, would these conservation projects go forward? And that's an important question, because certainly in an era of scarce state revenues, you don't want to contribute money when it's not going to make a difference to the project going forward or not. But what the study concluded was that the Betsy plays a significant role in these conservation projects going forward when capital constraints are the main obstacle for the project. And I would suggest that in these times, capital constraints are the problem. They are the constraint, as you heard earlier from Department of Energy. 65% of the money for this project has to come from other sources, including capital from these companies. And the Betsy has made the difference in terms of getting these projects out of just the development stage, but getting them actually done and through the door so those savings can be recognized. The second issue this study looked at was the question of jobs. Does this actually contribute to employment in the state? And the study concluded that for these conservation programs, they found large economic impacts compared to the project's costs. And even at low-end estimates of the potential economic impact, these conservation projects have a positive economic impact relative to the Betsy investment. These investments are not only necessary for these projects are producing positive results in terms of jobs and maintaining jobs and expansion of jobs. Lastly, I understand that we're looking at constraints on the amount of money available, and you're going to have to make tough choices in terms of where do those scarce dollars get allocated within the Betsy program. And for that, I refer you to one of the handouts. It's a study done by Echo Northwest that dealt with the relative savings benefits associated with public purpose funds. Different dollars, same results. And if you look at the table and do a little math, what you'll see is that compared to general conservation savings versus small renewable savings, the savings are a factor of 3 to 1 in favor of conservation. Conservation is a better investment in terms of energy savings than renewables, small renewables generally. But more importantly, you look at self-direct. Now, self-direct are conservation programs that are done by industrial customers of one average megawatt or more, types of people that I represent. And the multiplier there it's over 30 times. The benefit, the savings associated with those investments are over 30 times the benefits you receive from investment in small renewables. So my request is one that it's important to maintain this program, it's important to fund it, and because you have to make choices about where the funding goes, I think these numbers drive you to where the best value in terms of energy savings is for this program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Hickenmotter, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to testify in favor of Oregon's landmark business energy tax credit program. My name is Alan Hickenbottom, and I'm the general manager of Tanner Creek Energy, now a division of Christensen Electric, one of the largest electrical firms in the state. The firm was founded 66 years ago in Portland, is still locally owned and based, and employs over 300 union and non-union workers in Oregon and the region. Tanner Creek Energy's recent acquisition by this respected firm is a great example of the value and impact of the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. Our combined firms have participated in every facet of the Betsy program, putting up PV systems, working on large wind farms, EV charging stations, helping to build solar plants and others. That's building new energy sources, which is, in the current parlance, Jenny, installing efficiency members, which is Connie, and, of course, providing electrical construction services to various clean tech manufacturers in Manny. So, again, I can't stress enough the impact that it's had for us and our workers and their families and the economy of the state. As with any innovative program, it will not bat 1,000. When we're trying something new, it's not all going to go great. But I, having watched this program very strongly since the 2007 session and onward, for the vast majority of Betsy projects, they have delivered the benefits we have desired: energy production and savings, job creation, and carbon reduction. The renewable energy industry alone through this period has contributed $5.4 billion to Oregon's economy, and I would point you to the study that the gentleman before me spoke about. So while we understand this is a very difficult session, and I do want to thank each and every one of you for getting through this session, I'm sure you'll be having a fine time on June 30th when you're done. We would urge you to continue the program as you can, hoping it'll still be around, that we can allow it to be hopefully further funded as the economy improves, and we can continue to realize the benefits of this program, which has been a real, I think, boon to the state. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes. Air Brewer, you're...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. Both are for Ms. Mashinsky. Thank you for being here. Can you tell me where energy costs rank in terms of your business expenses?
Our primary expense is the fiber that goes into our paper, and energy is probably second. If you combine electricity and natural gas together, they're right up there.
Thank you. And another separate question. You mentioned that Betsy contributed $1.6 million of your total project cost of $6.5 million, but your savings are $1.2 million. What does your company do when it saves money of $1.2 million? What did it do with that?
It reinvests it for the most part. We are privately held. We don't have shareholders. It's a private, and we pretty much plow that all right back into our business. Those projects are, that savings is used to fund other projects, to make other improvements, and roll on down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You said something about capital constraints, which to me is another word for camouflaging the true cost of renewable energy to the ratepayers. What would you think if that artificial or that camouflage was removed? What would happen to ratepayers and their feeling on renewable energy as you deal with it?
You're asking a question about renewables, I take it.
Right, and conservation.
And I'm not sure I understand your question. My member companies are not investing to any significant degree in renewables. To the extent we're impacted by the renewable Betsy, it is because our electricity providers, such as Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp, are required, as discussed earlier, by the renewable portfolio standard to meet certain renewables targets. Now, that has been a benefit to my members as ratepayers in the past, because that has helped reduce the cost. But as you know, going forward, at least in the bills I've seen, there's not a proposal to continue to include large wind in the Betsy program. And I think the study I referenced before, in terms of the but-for question, concluded that for large wind, those projects would have gone forward whether there was a Betsy or not. And certainly, finally, one of the issues about the Betsy for large renewables is it's not just being used by companies such as PGE and Portland General to lower the cost to ratepayers in Oregon, but there are also California utilities who are using the Betsy to build significant projects in Oregon, and that power and those RECs are not being used in Oregon.
Follow-up. Yes. Let me clarify the question then.
Sure.
Because of the subsidy, the true cost of renewables to the ratepayer is being camouflaged. What would your ratepayers feel if, in fact, there wasn't a Betsy that's subsidizing and reducing their rates?
Oh, Yeah, I think there's a number of studies out there, including the Northwest Power Council study, the six power plant study, that has some comparative numbers. If you strip out all of the federal and state subsidies for the variety of the program, certainly for my ratepayers, certainly for large wind, if the Betsy went away, we would see an impact in terms of higher rates because the cost of the facility would be higher, and that cost would be passed through. And I think that is amplified even more significantly for some of the small renewables that are still being put forward and promoted. So eliminating the Betsy for renewables could have or would have an impact in terms of higher rates. But if you're asking me to make a choice, which between supporting renewables for conservation and supporting renewables for conservation, I think my membership is of the
choice between
funding Betsy's for renewables as opposed to funding Betsy's for conservation.
Thank you.
Our choice is fund conservation, particularly fund industrial conservation, because that translates to making investments within the fence of industrial customers. It makes them more competitive long term. It just doesn't simply buy down their power today. It provides long term benefits.
Well, I guess my question had to do with Senator Morris's question about using taxpayer dollars to bring down these rates, and they're not uniform, meaning not all ratepayers are recognizing the benefit of lower rates or keeping them lower because of the cost of renewables, but all tax dollars are going towards some ratepayers. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might, Senator Telfer, if I could just speak to your question briefly. The current budget situation notwithstanding, we'd say virtually every energy source in this country right now is subsidized. Renewables are new. Mm-hmm. And at this point probably require a little bit more. I will tell you, even in the, I guess, 5 years now I've been doing this work, that the incentives both here in Oregon and worldwide have done their job. We are doing our PV systems now, for example, are literally half the cost that they were when I started doing this 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So those are choices we make. I understand those are choices, difficult choices you guys have to make this session, and I understand that. But I do want to say that I think that the investments that we have made have brought the dividends we had hoped. Perhaps we need to take a pause right now, but hopefully not too much of a pause. But that I think there's many examples of where that investment has paid off. But you are right. It is an investment that Oregon taxpayers and ratepayers have made. We believe it's been worth it, but I think there's some numbers that would demonstrate that as well. Thank you for your question.
Thank you very much for coming, the three of you. And the next group is Justin Wood, John Chandler, and Cindy O'Neill.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on to speak specifically to the conservation aspects of the Betsy and Retsy programs. You've heard from me before, as has the Substantive Committee. Last night I emailed to each of you the testimony I submitted to the Substantive Committee from our association, both on behalf of new construction and remodeling. But today I have with me two of my members who can speak to their experiences from their business standpoint as to the efficacy of both these programs, Cindy O'Neill with Solaire Homes in Bend, and Justin Wood with Fish Construction in Portland, and I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you. Welcome. Just state your name and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss the value of the Retsy and Betsy to home builders in Central Oregon. My name is Cindy O'Neill. I am co-owner with Mike O'Neill of Solaire Home Builders in Central Oregon. We incorporated in 1995 and for the last 16 years have been
quite
homes.
So close. It's
okay.
Okay, it's a good mic.
Have been building homes that focus on energy efficiency, comfort, healthy indoor air quality, and homes that are affordable to the average person. We are winners of both national, regional, and local green building awards and are pleased to still be in business in Central Oregon. I'm sure we all share the value of homeownership and the effect that jobless rates and the high cost of living has had on the foreclosure rate in Oregon, and particularly Central Oregon, has been hard hit. And so I wanted to propose to you today that the RETC and BETC energy incentives do benefit home ownership and Oregon's economy. The RETC and BETC energy incentives benefit Oregon's economy because the incentives stimulate new home construction and create jobs. Our home buyers are definitely swayed. All of our home buyers come looking for a Greenbelt home, but are swayed to actually pull the trigger and sign a home contract when they hear about the energy incentives that are available to truly get their homes to be more energy efficient than a home just built to Oregon code. This is often a go or no-go situation, given the situation with the banks. Once they hear about the energy incentives and the kinds of tax credits they can get after they move into their home, we end up with, generally speaking, a home buyer. Each new home contract, on average, employs at least 160 people for about 6 months. Last year, we sold 7 homes. That employs 160 people for 18 months. That equates to $500,000 in paid person hours that otherwise might have been on the unemployment rolls. The RETC and BETC energy incentives benefit Oregon's economy because they stimulate better energy efficiency results in new home construction. The RETC and BETC stimulate home buyers to upgrade their energy selections to include such things as super insulated home shells, renewable energy like solar hot water panels or photovoltaic electric panels, energy efficient heating and cooling systems, and energy efficient appliances. These result in better energy efficiency results for our homes. All our homes are third-party certified. We model all our homes, and all of our homes are at least 30 to 50% more energy efficient than a home built to Oregon code. Well-documented studies in California and also here in the Pacific Northwest show that for every $1 you can save in energy costs over the year, it's a $20 increase in the future market value of their home. That means, on average, if our homes can save you $1,000 to $1,200 a year, you're increasing the future market value of your home from $20,000 to $24,000 when you sell it. This is very important to homeowners. A local study in the Pacific Northwest, sponsored by the Energy Trust, has shown that the market value of homes that are built to this standard are generally $3,000 to $9,000 more in market value. The RETC and BETC energy credits, the way that they're currently written, also stimulate innovation and better results. This year, for the first time ever, Central Oregon is going to see a zero-energy home built by Solaire. We're very proud to offer this home, and I have to tell you that the investors that are buying this home and putting it out into the open market in Northwest Crossing are intimately familiar with the BETC and RETC incentives and how they affect the market price. We're going to be able to offer this home at a price that is not lower but comparable to other market values in Northwest Crossing and Bend, Oregon. The RETC and BETC energy incentives benefit Oregon's economy because it keeps home builders like Solaire in business. As a 100% energy efficient custom home builder, we have found that the RETC and BETC incentivized home upgrades have increased our gross income by about 6.6% over the last 3 years. What this means to us is $494,000 in gross income we wouldn't have otherwise seen. This is just the energy upgrades, not our total income, but just the energy upgrades that we hadn't seen if the RETC and BETC tax credits hadn't stimulated home buyers to add to their home package. This amount of income has made all the difference to us in weathering the current recession. As we at Solaire pull out of the recession with the help of incentives like the RETC and BETC, we're going to be able to be offering more new home construction, more jobs, better energy efficiency results, better homeowner cash flow and stability, better long-term market value, better energy innovation in home construction, better bottom line and gross taxable income. The RETC and BETC energy incentives do benefit Oregon's economy now and for the future. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Justin Wood with Fish Construction. I wanted to talk a little bit specifically more about the Red Sea program, just because we build starter homes for families. And we do about 12 to 15 homes a year, and each of those homes employs about 100 people a year. Typically, our home buyers aren't necessarily looking for energy upgrades. They're more looking for just the most inexpensive home they can get into in the house. If it weren't for the Red Sea credits or other credits available and rebates available that we're able to offer to our home buyers, they wouldn't otherwise be able to purchase these homes. Typically for us, we're not offering these homes at any type of a premium for any type of these energy upgrades that we put into the homes. It's more it's more of a selling feature, but for the homeowners, it's a way to get them into a more energy efficient home. Historically, we've been building for 35 years, all in the starter market, and we've never been able to put the energy upgrades into our homes. It's been within about the last 3 to 4 years, thanks in large part to the Red Sea credits and different rebates offered through other providers, that we've been able to move into that market. And with that, we've been able to open up buyers and hear stories and testimonials from our buyers that have really benefited from the things we've been able to put into our houses. Just recently, we built a home that was sold at $225,000, which for infill Portland is right at a starter market pricing. And I just heard from the homeowner who bought the house that their 1,450-square-foot home this last winter had a $50 a month energy bill. And as you can imagine, for people, that it was a single mother, for her that was huge, as opposed to somebody else who might have a $200 or $300 house, and she wouldn't have been able to buy that house if it weren't for different programs available to her. Basically, that's kind of what I just wanted to touch on, the importance of these programs to people building starter homes and the people in our market, and what it means to our buyers. I want to really stress the importance of programs that maintain those for those buyers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fish. Thank you. Questions for this panel from the committee? Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for coming over from Bend all the way.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I have another panel, Jerry Page, Mary Mann, and Jeremy Anderson. Go ahead.
Right. We'll let Jeremy start.
Okay. That's any order.
Co-chairs, committee members, good morning. My name is Jeremy Anderson. I work with WISE, the Trade Association of Weatherization Contractors, and I have just provided you with plenty of written testimony to read over, so I'm going to try and keep what I have to say short.
Appreciate that.
Just quick introduction about what these two are going to talk about, which is a very small section of the conservation portion. I think we've all heard well enough today that conservation is the greatest thing out there. It is the least cost and lowest risk way to meet our energy needs. But there's a very specific subsection, which is the weatherization program. The vast majority of that weatherization program is for rental housing. And that's a key point to remember, because in rental housing, the person making the investment, the property owner, does not receive the return on that investment, because they don't typically pay the utility bills. They'll talk a lot about what that means, but in short, it means it takes a significant incentive from the state in order to make that happen, because the owner has no financial incentive to make that investment on their own. The other thing I want to talk about quickly are the numbers, since that seems to be the thing of the day. I believe it was last week you all received a study from our good friends in Massachusetts on Betsy, and unfortunately they got one key assumption wrong on weatherization. And that's the same point that we talked about. They're looking at internal rate of return. On weatherization projects, internal rate of return has zero bearing on whether these projects move forward or not, because again, that return does not go to the investor. Therefore, they said that about 10% of weatherization projects are Betsy dependent. I would submit that it's about 100%. When you extrapolate that out through their financial and economic analysis, you'll find that weatherization for every Betsy dollar provides about $2.50 in payroll, and a net economic additional activity of about $10 over the course of that project. So with that, I would ask you very carefully to read all of the too many pieces of paper I had to hand you, and we'll hand it off to people who actually do the work.
Thank you. Jerry.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Page. I have Total Comfort Weatherization here in Salem, and for about 3.5 decades, we've specialized in retrofitting existing buildings, apartments, rental houses, duplexes. And should have heard what Jeremy had to say first, so I'll just be as brief as I can. I just want to make the real strong point that there's a distinction, a big distinction between the Connie and these other tax credits, is that when I go and talk to a property owner and I say we want to weatherize your apartment, your duplex, your house, why? I don't pay the utility bill. There's no benefit. You know, in the top 10 things that I need to spend money on, conservation isn't even on it's not even on the list. So when we go through and we explain in great detail, and over the course of usually a year and a half, it sinks in, we have to keep working on them. We bundle the benefits of the 35% tax credit along with the incentives that are available through the energy trust programs. And when you combine these together, you know, maybe you'll get 50% paid for, maybe you'll get 60 or 70% paid for. And even then, it's a very small percentage of landlords that will go ahead. Most of them don't have any tax liability to begin with. So then we explain the pass-through option. Organizations such as the Catholic Community Services own and they're acquiring older apartments, and they're refurbishing them. They use the Betsy and the Energy Trust credits and the pass-through option, because they pay zero taxes, to get enough money to combine with their other sources of revenue to go ahead and fully weatherize these apartments, because their tenants are very low income and they can't afford high energy bills. Not being able to afford your utility bills is the second leading cause of homelessness in the state of Oregon. 4 years ago, the PUC Commissioner John Savage talked about the cost of energy. Conservation is about 3 cents a kilowatt hour. He said if you generate energy with gas, it's about 9. Nuclear, they said, was 12. So conservation, by far, is the wisest investment in the use of Oregon's funds. So 30 years ago, the Oregon legislature recognized these facts. These facts have not changed. And by statute, conservation was supposed to be the highest priority for the use of the business energy tax credit. It still is. So anyway, the legislature got it right 30 years ago. Hopefully you'll take all the same considerations and continue on with that thought.
Madam Chairperson, members of the panel, my name is Mary Mann. I own Goose Hollow Window Company. I'm in Lake Oswego, Oregon. This is my 31st year as an independent person helping people with windows and doors. Goose Hollow Window Company since 86, 87. I'm elected representative of the City Council of the City of River Grove, part of the Rental Housing Association of Greater Portland, Oregon Remodeling Association, NARI, and WISE. And since 95, I've predominantly been helping investors weatherize apartment buildings. I also own rental property. And one of the things that we have seen predominantly is that with this economic downturn, owners have basically stopped investing in their rental properties. It's not a pretty sight. It's just indicative of what's been going on in the general economy. What we are seeing, however, is with the stabilization of rentals and rental occupancy, which is a very important part of stabilizing and seeing what's happening in the economy as it recovers. People are not buying homes yet, but they are filling up the apartments, which is the beginning of what we're going to see as part of the recovery. That's providing stability to rental property owners to start saying, oh my goodness, now we're not bleeding. We're now seeing where maybe we can start to paint our building or to replace the windows or add insulation. So I, as the person at the bottom and starting after a year to see people calling me saying, I'd like to take a look at my apartments, take a look at weatherizing, which is going to cost me. We've got the Energy Trust of Oregon incentives. We have the business energy loan program, which no one's mentioned here, which is not taxpayer money but bond money. Those things, along with this tax credit, all marry together to create the incentives. And as Jerry will say, we're still seeing people that just can't seem to quite make that bridge because they don't have the actual value of, they don't pay the heat bill. But what they do have to do is deal with turnover. So these tax credit programs that have worked for 30 years are part of this generalized economic recovery, and it's one of the cheapest programs you'll ever see because you don't have to create a new program. If everyone listens to the news about the federal government or state, try to create a new program that will have as much market identification as a much market presence as these programs have is very, very difficult. None of the people that I talk to don't know about the tax credit programs and incentives. The marketing has been done for 30 years. To stop these programs is basically throwing 30 years out for a very short-term benefit to the state so that you don't have this income or tax credits, you know, basically not coming back in. What we're also seeing is tenants, as Jerry mentioned, we have 1 in 5 children are hunger compromised. Many of these are a huge amount are in rental property. When you can save somebody $30 and $50 a month, I'd say that is a minimum in their heat bills. That translates to being able to feed their children. It comes back into not being able to pay their heat bills. It translates back to just enough stabilization to allow people not to leave their rental houses and become homeless. I cannot encourage anyone on this council. I know it's a decision you have to make is a very difficult one. Same thing we have to do in our own homes. You know, what do you pay and what do you not pay? And this tax credit program is about a $3.5 million program, generates at least $10 to $12 million worth of jobs. And that doesn't translate to the fuel savings, and it doesn't translate to the economic spinoffs. What happens is when you're putting people to work. And one of the things is I'm a self-employed person. Self-employed people in Oregon make up a huge percentage of what makes this economy turn, and yet, unfortunately, we're invisible. When people talk about creating jobs, they have this idea you're going to take somebody who has a high school education and turn them into a plumber or a window caulker or somebody who's going to do insulation. All those huge numbers of people that have been self-employed have never taken unemployment in the last 2 to 3 years. We are invisible, because we can't take the unemployment and still go out and attempt to make a living with our jobs. So by this conservation, which is a huge portion of the construction industry, you're going to allow our factories to start running with full capacity, maybe adding another third of their employees. Right now, if you take a look at Milgard, you take a look at Empire Pacific, you take a look at Geldwin, some of these companies, they won't tell you, but you walk into their factories and they're almost empty. We never saw that before. And if you want to put people back to work, they've got skilled labor sitting on the sidelines waiting for this mythological economic upturn again. And this is one of the things right now we're starting to see this crack. We're starting to see people get their funds back. A lot of owners of rental properties, like Jerry said and Jeremy, they actually take this money out of their own pocket. They're not taking it out of the profits coming from the buildings themselves. They take it out of their own savings, their own investments. And when you talk to property management people, often they'll be telling and discouraging their own owners from investing in doing these upgrades because it doesn't pencil out on their mythological 5-year payback formulas. So here we are trying to encourage them to invest in their properties where they're not getting a payback immediately. We have all these things tearing at us, and the investor is sitting there in the middle, like, what do we do? What do we do? So without the state kind of giving this extra push and the marriage between the energy trust, we don't have these programs going forward.
If I can add, I tried to cut my testimony up a little bit so I wasn't repetitive, but the 3 points that I didn't make that I meant to is this program applies to the entire state, every region of it, not just right. One city or one industry. Number two, I'd like to be the second testimony, but in there is a return on investment to the state of Oregon, and that study that Jeremy put out, and I think the rate of return to the state of Oregon was 10%. Is that correct? Or I don't know exactly how it was stated.
I think what Jerry's perhaps alluding to is if you there's some comments on the recent study done by, again, I forget the name
could
of it.
Could we finish so we can get, yeah.
I think that'd be great.
Yeah,
okay, and just the last point that I want to make is the uncertainty that's present with the approval through the Betsy has killed us. Last year at this time, I had 55 employees doing conservation. Now I have 12. I can put them back to work within a week if I can get these approvals and this moving again.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Jody Weiser, you are the only one who signed up on the negative side, and we have a few minutes. I hope you have enough time. I don't want to cut you short.
It seems that the Betsy is just like the education budget. Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. It needs to keep coming up. The budget, the education budget comes up every year, and the Betsy is a massive investment by our state, and it also needs to come up every year. So I'm concerned about extending the sunset of these bills to 10.5 years from now, because we all know that any real changes will require a 3/5 vote. And that's not exactly easy to get in this building. Further, I don't think that anybody's mentioned the fact that the bill we passed in last February gives $400 million to manufacturing and renewable energy. We've made that commitment. It must be in the revenue forecast. And so it's like those numbers just aren't being mentioned here today, and yet they're there. And in fact, the manufacturing cap is kind of like this. I'm used to spending $50,000 a year. I'm putting you on a budget of no more than $100,000 a year. That's kind of what we did in last February. If you look at the spreadsheet before you, we do see progression, a growth in the size of the manufacturing Betsy's we've been passing out. But it seems to me we really need to look at whether these programs could go forward with reductions, just like every other part of the state's budget is going forward with reductions. The final point would be that there has to come a point when the solar cluster is finished. It doesn't need our support anymore. The footwear cluster doesn't get a bunch of money every time a new company comes to our state. The solar cluster has been built. It's built quite vigorously. I was told 2 years ago, as soon as we had thin film, it would be complete. Well, solar power is thin film, and yet we're making a commitment 10.5 years in the future to continue this cluster. I think you really need to stop and consider. Thank you.
Questions for Jody? Thank you, Jody, and I hope I didn't. You can sign up again. And yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Now, we will continue this to Thursdays, and so with that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3582. Those of you who have signed up, I'll get you up in the order going forward on Thursday, and we appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned. On Thursday, and we appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned.